Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I had intended to make this statement in the House of Commons, the appropriate place, in my view, for something as important as this. But the Speaker ruled that because it revisited controversial issues from yesterday, that was not appropriate. So I'm going to read you the statement I was about to make in the House. It'll take a couple of minutes. Before I start, the name of my constituency is Halton, Price and Howden. Halton, Price is derived from medieval proverb meaning noble endeavour. Up until yesterday, I took the view that what we did in the House of Commons representing our constituents was a noble endeavour because with centuries of forebears, we defended the freedoms of the British people. Or we did, up until yesterday. This Sunday is the anniversary of Magna Carta, the document that guarantees that's most fundamental of British freedoms, habeas corpus, the right not to be imprisoned by the state without charge or reason. But yesterday this House decided to allow the state to lock up potentially innocent citizens for up to 6 weeks without charge. Now the counter-terrorism bill will in all probability be rejected by the House of Lords very firmly. After all, what should they be there for if not to defend Magna Carta? But because the impetus behind this is essentially political, not security, the government will be tempted to use the Parliament Act to overrule the Lords. It has no democratic mandate to do this, since 42 days was not in its manifesto. Its legal basis is uncertain, to say the least. But purely for political reasons, this government's going to do that. And because the generic security arguments relied on will never go away, technology, development of complexity and so on, we'll next see 56 days, 70 days, 90 days. But in truth, 42 days is just one, perhaps the most salient example of the insidious, surreptitious and relentless erosion of fundamental British freedoms. Now, we will have shortly the most intrusive identity card system in the world, a CCTV camera for every 14 citizens, a DNA database bigger than any dictatorship has, with thousands of innocent children and a million innocent citizens on it. We've witnessed an assault on jury trials, that bulwark against bad law and its arbitrary abuse by the state. Shortcuts with our justice system that make our system neither firm nor fair. And the creation of a database state, opening up our private lives to the prying eyes of official snoopers and exposing our personal data to careless civil servants and criminal hackers. The state has security powers to clamp down on peaceful protest and so-called hate laws that stifle legitimate debate, whilst those who incite violence get off scot-free. This cannot go on. It must be stopped. And for that reason, today I feel it's incumbent on me to take a stand. I will be resigning my membership of this House, and I intend to force a by-election in Halton, Price and Howden. Now, I'll not fight it on the government's general record. There's no point repeating Crewe and Nantwich. I won't fight it on my personal record. I am just a piece in this great chess game. I will fight it. I will argue this by-election against the slow strangulation of fundamental British freedoms by this government. Now, that may mean I've made my last speech to the House. It's possible. And of course that would be a cause of deep regret to me. But at least my electorate and the nation as a whole would have had the opportunity to debate and consider one of the most fundamental issues of our day. The ever-intrusive power of the state into our lives, the loss of privacy, the loss of freedom, and the steady attrition undermining the rule of law. And if they do send me back here, it will be with a single, simple message. That the monstrosity of a law that we passed yesterday will not stand. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'll talk to you later.
American media is a business, and it has a mission. Not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with the capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive. It's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And now, for Newsreel, here's Sean Kennedy.
And it is a good day! This is Sean Kennedy, reporting to you from the internet for Monday, June 23rd, 2008. Is it June or July? Yeah, it is June. And you're listening to Newsreel! In June, the Law Global SIDRAP on core political tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. Rand Media is taking a stand for free speech today. And just by listening and distributing this program, you are also taking a stand for free speech and will quite probably wind up in jail. You can follow up on all these news stories, and you can check my facts by going to my live journal. And you can get to my live journal by going to sean_kennedy.livejournal.com. This is a free podcast that can be heard on Rant Radio, SRN1, Wild Bunch Radio, WNY Media Network, KJAG Radio, Pure Rock Radio, Radio Red Mercury, and as well, we broadcast this usually on Thursdays-ish at 7 p.m. PDT on Node Archers, grid coordinates 137102-9999. And if you want to get to into see the show performed live, you have to basically sell your soul and sign up with some sort of like virtual reality program, and eventually it'll consume your life and you'll be driven into seething madness. And for those people that have been driven into seething madness, they are now living in the new wasteland at grid 34031941N 117372950 West. And you can just turn on Google Maps, hack that little Zoom feature, get right in there, and see those poor unfortunate people who are slowly being driven out into the wastelands to build a new community, which they march to the rhythm of the drum's beat by the madness of their own imagination. So let's talk about that intro. Yes, that would be David Davis quitting over the anti-terror plot, where now in England they can hold you for 42 days for no reasons whatsoever. He was the Conservative Party's Home Affairs spokesman, and he resigned. But what happened was, here's the trick. See, he wanted to read out this speech to the House of Commons, right? Which is, you know, where they're supposed to go out and read the speech and stuff like that. Say, listen, blah, 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 blah. But they didn't even let him read the speech out. So what he does is he walks outside to where all the news cameras are, busts out his notepad, and he just goes to town. And he that, of course, was caught by all the news cameras. And, of course, the news cameras then, you know, it got put on the web, and I thought it was so terribly, terribly important that I thought I should put that on the intro to the show. Interesting, isn't it, how things can develop in our world? When you look at all the things that are happening right now, there's stuff happening now that you never even thought would be happening like 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Maybe you're new to the information age. Maybe you've been floating around out there on the fringe for a while. But man, oh man, all the stuff that's in the old science fiction books about the dystopian future is all coming true, and it seems like I get to be the disc jockey giving you the local fallout as the days go on. Got some feedback here. Let's get into the feedback. Here's Sean. Hello, Rant. Sorry, not a dear Sean. It was Hello, Ron. I just want to say hi to Sean and Tim. Hi. Keep up the good work, guys. I've been listening to you guys and watching Rant Media for almost 4 years. Now, ever since I was 21, I hate you. All day I'm surrounded by corporate fucks and pacified drones. Thank God for the few people who don't fall into one of those categories or both. The work your organization does is important. It reminds people that there are others out there, others like them out there. I give you my email, Addy, but I'm about to go through a bunch of interviews, and companies are often looking online to learn more about you. And call it what it is, they spy on you. I think that's paranoid. A friend of mine just got a job, and he told me they questioned him about his Plenty of Fish account, which he never told them about in his interview. Infidel. Isn't that interesting? Yes. Your dating programs, all your social networking. Yes. Yes, that's right. They're writing it down. They're going to be using it against you. Wow, my sound levels were really, really out of whack there. Okay, better. Better, better, better. Sorry for the peaking, for everyone who's recording this in Second Life. Of course, you know, because we do the show live in Second Life. And Infidel, it's a good point. You know, there's our rights are essentially gone. That's one of the things I'm starting to think about, by the way, for the show. Well, just for people, you know, the mindset of the WOG, right? The WOG is about one thing, and the WOG is about survival. And some people might say, well, Sean, you know, there's limits to what you're willing, I'm willing to go through to survive. And that's a choice. You know, people can all choose. But, I mean, it seems like, you know, you've got to be careful with certain concepts and ideas. Like, you don't want to become fanatical. You know, the concept here is to survive. And if you notice that you're, like, it's the same thing with everything. If you're in a race and you're in a car and that car keeps losing the race, you got to think to yourself, why is this car losing the race? It appears to be good. And then you look at the cars that are winning the race and you go, you know, why is that car winning the race and the car I'm in not winning the race? And then you can, like, model the design of the car after that. You know, and that's why the military, I mean, unfortunately, I'm of the belief that power really does come from the barrel of a gun. There's some people who don't buy into that, but you know what? You only have the rights you're willing to fight for, and that's a fact. But you can't really fight against the state, because if the individual goes against the state, well, they get their name on a nice plaque somewhere maybe one day, but beyond that, you wind up getting taken out. So you got to think maybe there's ways you can work within the system. You got to be smart. You know, you got to think about it. Dear Sean Kennedy, you mentioned the last time, Sean, how you feel that elections are a big sham. I agree. I feel the following scenario may happen around election time. Nearing the election, there will be a terrorist attack, cough, and the president will postpone the elections due to safety concerns. The martial law will go into effect, basically giving the president supreme power to do whatever he wants. The dictatorship will take hold, or anarchy. Maybe just my imagination, but it may still happen. Anonymous. No, you got that all wrong. What's going to happen is Barack Obama is going to be on the verge of victory. Clinton's going to be his support structure. Either if McCain wins, McCain's going to die of a heart attack, and then it'll fall over to Obama, who gets shot, and then Hillary takes over, and she basically becomes like the mother savior figure to lead the nation, Margaret Thatcher style, you know, essentially. Hello, Sean and Sim. I was recently listening to your archives and found a story about kids being put on antipsychotic drugs. During my time in school, my parents forced me to take Ritalin and other drugs like it. My marks plummeted and I became dangerously skinny. I nearly stopped eating due to the side effects of the drugs. After finally getting off of them in grade 9, I got my life back on track, raising my average from 65 to an 80. Pretty scary. They want us drugged and stupid. Thanks for discussing this topic, Tyrant Number One. Well, you know, it is something near and dear to my heart, the farmer fascist state, which is, you know, coming into being as we speak. Dear Sean Kennedy, here it is. You know you're in shit when. I was listening to the show when you started talking about races and that some seem to excel in certain areas. Whoa, I don't think that's exactly what I said. And even if that was what I said, what I'm saying here is that there are differences between races. Okay, there are differences. You know what I'm saying? That's why they can identify them. Like blacks in sports because of the much larger amount of black people in sports than in the USA. But don't you think that being slaves for a long time and being breeded with other physically strong slaves, according to Chris Rock, don't know if this is true though, it does seem kind of far-fetched, would result in physically strong black population? Also, with a large part of the black population being poor, at least it used to be, do you think that basketball and other sports would be a nice way of escaping this situation? Also, being a cheap way of passing a lot of time, don't you think it would be motivation to play the sport a lot? And just because a lot of people play a sport, some of them will be good, and that's just strategies. Apart from this, you see a large portion of the Olympics being dominated by blacks or other races. Is it mainly countries with large populations and money to spend on sports? Also, winter sports, like cross-country skiing, are they dominated by blacks? I can't remember seeing many blacks there. It's mainly white people from countries that ski a fair amount. Wouldn't blacks still excel if they were predisposed to sports and physical strength? Now, to me, it seems like it has a lot more to do with culture, or does that seem implausible? Flaffin, no, dude, that's not implausible. I don't know. All I'm saying here is, okay, is that, you know, it seems to me that, like, I don't know about skiing. You know what I mean? I'm not saying any one race is better or superior. It's just that when you look at a people who are consistently winning sprinting races, they're people out of Africa, because I think there's something to do with how the body has developed over time. Just like, you know, everyone's got their areas where they're better than other people, and other people have areas where they're not better. I mean, it's one thing to say, like, there are differences. It's okay to say you're different. That's okay. You know what I mean? Like, there's no reason why any men should be flying planes, like fighter jets, for example. I mean, women are off the chart. They're better at hand-eye. You know, they've got all that shit down. They've got a higher pain tolerance, better life expectancy. They can handle blood flow better. Every single fighter pilot should be a woman right from the get-go because they're genetically better at it. I don't think they should be combat troops because I don't think they're genetically designed to do that. You know, whereas men are generally a large mud-slinging, you know, club-throwing, axe-wielding psychos. Yes, there are large psycho club-wielding, axe-swinging psycho chicks, but they're an exception, not the norm. You know what I mean? Anybody who disagrees with me, why don't we just put men versus women in the UFC? You can take whoever you want. I'll take Ken Shamrock. Go. I mean, it's ridiculous because people are different. We men cannot make babies. That doesn't make us politically inferior. It just means that we cannot make babies. That is how it works. Well, we can do it with science now. Jesus Christ. You know, you're missing the whole point here. But, you know, Flaffin, I see where you're going here. I'm not a racist, all right? I'm not. I'm just saying that there are probably differences in some people. Like, for example, the Inuit. Classic example, the Inuit. The Inuit have a layer of fat on their body that no other, quote-unquote, race has. Seriously, look it up. They can live and survive in temperatures that would just kill anybody. I mean, they walk around with, like, sweatshirts on and temperature that would freeze yours and mine nuts off. It's just because they're genetically, that's how they're genetically developed, evolved, I suppose you would say. But people get all freaked out when you start talking about, you know, differences between races and stuff like that. It's like, nobody really wants you to be aware that there are differences. Yeah, there's differences. There are differences. It doesn't mean that one's better than the other and stuff like that, but there are differences. It's okay to say that. It's when people start saying, no, these are inferior races, and they blanket the whole race as being inferior. No. Every group has some, you know, areas where they're stronger, but that doesn't mean the areas that they're not as strong are weak. You see what I'm saying? It gets complicated, and it turns into a real sticky issue. But anyway, let's get into some news. Some good news. Mod chips have been found legal in the UK, so they're not going to throw you in jail for 42 days for that, unless you're a terrorist modding chips. For many years, we've wondered what some folks considered the process of mod chipping to be legal. Illegal. After all, if you own a device, why should you not be able to modify it? It's not illegal to modify your computer, so why would it be illegal to modify a game console? Well, thanks to the DMCA in the United States, the question wasn't entirely clear, because console makers use encryption. They consider any modification to be a circumvention of that encryption. The DMC has that pesky anti-circumvention clause. In the U.S., it's becoming even more bizarre, with federal officials taking up the case and fining mod chippers while claiming seriously that mod chipping was a national security issue. Luckily, it looks like the courts in Europe are a lot more reasonable about all of this. A few years back, we noticed the Italian court ruled that mod chips were perfectly legal. Well, darn, and there was an update to this story. As the commentator notes, the Italian decision was later overturned. And now the tipster alerts us to the news that the UK appeals court has found the same thing, tossed out all the charges against a mod chip seller, noting the mod chips do not circumvent copyrighted systems. So that's a good thing. So mod chipping is there, but it just shows how, you know, like I said in the after now, we're not allowed to modify things and soldering irons and things like that become illegal. This will be the beginning of that. That is what the DMCA is. Cyberpunk Kit. Thank you very much, Stripey, for sending me this story. This is a great story about waste gas. The standard extractor is Extreme Biodiesel's original processor. Now, this is an amazing thing. This is a thing that makes gas. It was released after 2 years of research and development, and we spared no expense in our design, safety, and functionality of our extractor systems. Yes, you and Jurassic Park. We spared no expense. Unlike most of the biodiesel processors on the market today, we use only high-quality components in the construction of our biodiesel extractors, to include polypropylene, polyethylene, and Teflon. These components are fully compatible with all of the necessary chemicals for producing biodiesel. Our custom tanks are made specifically for processing biodiesel by using double blah 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 blah. But what we got here is, if you go to the link and check it out, this buddy has got himself a company where he is selling biodiesel makers so that you can make your own biodiesel. All you people in Second Life, do not freak out. I will be posting links at the end of the show. But yeah, very, very slick. And, you know, I'm thinking a little bit about the biodiesel thing. That's pretty interesting, because unlike all these other really radical, you know, fuel technologies they're working on, I don't think they're going to give biodiesel a fair push because, well, you can make it on your own. Anybody can make biodiesel. Biodiesel seems to be a fairly wogtastic choice. You know what I'm saying? Like, that seems to be the way you want to go with this. Because biodiesel, any fuel that you can manufacture and completely, you know, leave the grid, so to speak, that's a pretty powerful thing. All we got to do is put that in the flying car division, which brings us to, always popular, flying car news. If what keeps you from buying your own personal ultralight aircraft is lack of garage space and a USB plug on the plane's dash for your iPod, you are certainly in luck! Los Angeles startup Icon Aircraft this week unveiled its A5 ultralight sport plane, which the company hopes will open a new market made up of amateur pilots zipping around the skies with style. Yes, you see, in 2004, the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration created a new classification of sport pilot license that only requires 20 hours of in-flight training, no medical check, and half the cost of a traditional pilot's license. With the pilot bar set to an unprecedented low, not since they let a couple of bicycle repairmen tool around with the Tittyhawk in North Carolina. No, they were the other brothers. Companies such as Icon are looking to get rich. Icon focuses on special touches that are time-tested appeal to the mass market, namely looking good and not killing the operator. The two-seater A5 includes an intuitive sports car-like cockpit with an MP3 player port, which runs both auto and aviation gasoline, and sports retractable wings that make the plane fit snugly in a large garage. It's also got safety kits such as propeller guard and the whole airframe parachute for those times when finding a landing strip is just too damn inconvenient. The Icon CEO Kirk Hawking says the aircraft brings freedom, fun, and adventure back into aviation. Note, apparently at some point piloting a regular personnel craft has become yawn way too boring. The plane starts at $139,000 with initial models scheduled to be delivered in late 2010. That's assuming things go well when the full-scale prototype begins flight tests this summer. Look into the sky. If you see a ball of screaming death fire plummeting from above you, you know it's time to seek the refund required on the $5,000 deposit. There's more about the plane to Popular Mechanics, including a video of its unveiling. Warning, audience comments about the plane such as, "This would be perfect for the Bahamas," would make you extremely bitter if you're going home to a studio apartment and a peanut butter and sandwich dinner. So, it's interesting, they're talking about this plane. This reminds me of Shades of Moeller. You know, these guys are trying to drum up on him. Moeller's got his car! It's coming, you know. He hasn't really got it there, but at least they're talking about flying cars. I don't think we'll ever see them. I don't think they'll ever get legalized. They'll come up with some reason why they can't happen. But the minute they get available, you let me know, because I'm getting me a flying car. And now in CellNet news, this was sent in by Wyandi, crazy story. Cell phones may be nearly ubiquitous in today's world, but a number of people who have seemed to have adopted proper cell phone etiquette, gadget etiquette in general, often seems to be far smaller. Microsoft has filed a patent application 2008-125-102, on technology it feels could address such situations via the use of what the company referred to as the Digital Manners Policy, or DMP for short. The patent abstract states, "The present invention includes methods and technologies for defining, administering, process, blah, 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 legalese, legalese, legalese." Microsoft draws a number of analogies between DMP and common social conventions already in practice today. DMP, as the company envisions it, is meant to address some of the security and privacy concerns resulting from mobile devices, such as concerns ranging from unintentional rudeness to critical security and privacy matters. Such mobile device intrusions may be summarized as socially undesirable, audible or visual disturbances, or unauthorized information or data capture. The DMP-equipped devices would be capable of receiving and applying DMP orders given to them by appropriate broadcast device. The wording... orders. The wording and the patent implies such the broadcasters would be short-range and are physically restricted. So essentially, you've got cell phone shutdown. So you've got the ability to put in a thing inside a movie theater that turns off everybody's cell phone. Isn't that a great thing? Let's just restrict your comms even more. We've already metered communication where, you know, nobody is allowed to, communicate, which is, well, not freely. You know, I mean, they pay you, you have to pay for every second which you're communicating. At any moment, they can turn off your tracking device that they let you speak through. And, you're completely bitched. They turn off your credit cards, you have no access. I mean, how much money do you have on you right now? All the power goes out right now, doesn't come back on. How much money do you have lying around? I don't have any. I got some change. I think I might have like 10 pounds in my wallet, but I live in Canada, so that's not going to help me. You know, I mean, seriously, I don't keep a lot of cash lying around. Maybe that's something you should think about. Should you or should you not keep a lot of cash around? You know, I'll tell you that. It's an interesting idea. It's an interesting idea, but you can't let yourself get too paranoid about this sort of stuff, you know? Because eventually things, you start going down that road, you got to start thinking, well, why don't I go a little bit more Section 9 with this? That's why the Ghost in the Shell approach of becoming more tactical, using the tactical advantage, evolving as, I think I think WOGs are really a lot of Starship Troopers is going into WOGs. A lot of tactical thinking is going into WOGs. you know, the great fathers of the of you know, modern tactical thinking. You know, I'm not one of them by any stretch of the imagination. I just gave it a name. You know, but there's some serious inspiration when you go out there and you look at the survival mindset. You know, people like Paul Howe. Great book. Anybody wants to read it. Paul Howe's Leadership and Training for the Fight. Outstanding book. Great book. Paul Howe was one of the dudes from Black Hawk Down. Amazing guy. Amazing guy. But anyway, moving on. In Intel news, or any company moving, any company moving to embrace Enterprise 2.0, some resistance to the tools first gained traction when the consumer space is often inevitable. But when the CIA began pitching Intellipedia and Wikipedia, Wikipedia-like projects for its analyst spies, they were met with some fierce critics. We were called traitors, and we were told we're going to get people killed. Don Burke, Intellipedia's doyen in the CIA, said today at Enterprise 2.0 conference. Sean Denny, the CIA's Intellipedia evangelist, added selling superiors to the use of such a collaboration tool was especially tricky. They're talking about spies with this thing they created called Intellipedia, which is a Wikipedia for the intelligence community. We still call spies collaborators, he noticed. We're trying to encourage collaboration, but there is still a negative connotation to that word. Despite the early challenges, the CIA now uses it on its top secret and sensitive unclassified networks, reading and editing a central wiki which has been enhanced by a YouTube-like video channel and a Flickr photo sharing, content tagging, blogs, and RSS feeds. So there's like a CIA Wikipedia intelligence database. Oh, baby. Oh, baby, baby, baby. I wonder how big that is. Oh, baby, baby. What I wouldn't give to get my hands on that. Underscoring how vital Intellipedia has become to the agency, the CIA has been providing briefings about data posted on the wiki since October 2007. According to the pair, they did not provide details on who or what agencies or what briefing based on the content on the project. Burke noted that Intellipedia, including instructions from the 1944 CIA field manual for sabotaging companies, the manual suggests that agents encourage companies to use channels to make decisions. Now, this goes on to today's Wikipedia. Wikimedia, where I have a sabotage manual from 1944, and if you read about how you're supposed to be making decisions and stuff, they talk about committees and stuff like that, so how to sabotage any organization. And when you look at how people are trying to run concepts based upon fairness and equality and all this kind of stuff, you'll be finding that there's lots of committees that people seem to think that fairness and equality goes with committees somehow and voting and crap like that, which really it doesn't. I think that there's a way that you can streamline this with a lot of common sense and really a lot of trust in your people. So it's interesting. If you check out the link, read it, you'll understand what I mean. It's pretty interesting stuff. It's pretty interesting stuff. In brain case news, this is an interesting story. American armaments goliath Northrop Grumman has announced another huge technology coup this week. The company has won the Pentagon contract to develop a mind-reading hat, which will allow U.S. soldiers to identify threats with unparalleled range and speed. The military requirement was actually called the Cognitive Technology Threat Warning System, the CT-2WS. But Northrop didn't have a truck with crazy acronyms of that type, so instead they refer to the proposed kit as the Hornet, the Human-Aided Optical Recognition Notification of Elusive Threats. Hornet leverages the latest advances in real-time coupling of human brain activity with automated cognitive neural processing to provide superior target direction, says Michael House, Northrop executive in charge of the Brain Hat Black Hat Direct Detector Kit. Hornet is envisioned as some kind of mind probe augmented set of binos. As the soldier sweeps his surroundings in the hostile combat zones of 2012, a custom helmet equipped with electroencephalogram electrodes placed in the scalp will be checking for what his subconscious mind is makes of what he is seeing. The idea is that the primitive parts of the human brain can spot threats the conscious mind will miss. When the paranoid IC spots a threat, the Hornet Intellecto Specs will register this and flash up a marker on the screen, allowing the conscious mind to know what has spooked its deeper levels. The initial breadboard prototype system is set to cost $6.7 million. Longtime Reg readers won't have needed the headline to guess the source of the taxpayer greenbacks. Needless to say, the Hornet is brought to you by DARPA, that famed Pentagon wingnut hothouse. The wacky military notionaries have always believed that America's brains could be its best weapon on wars on stuff, although not normally quite literally as this. Northrop will lead a consortium of academic and industrial partners in the program. We suggest, instead of that name, we should go with Human Enhanced Acquisition and Detection for Counter-Strike and Advanced of Surprise Elements, Headcase, or the Neural Upgrade Technology joined to Optical Binoculars, Nutjob, or even my favorite, Man Portable Intellect Network Detection Field Utilization for Celestrius Kills, Mindfuck. Perfect. Awesome acronyms. Gotta love the Yanks for the acronyms. They're awesome for that. You know, they always get the cool code names. Canadians get shitty code names. We get code names like Operation Mallard Frostbite. You know, stupid. Anyway, in Brain Hack News, keeping on... Yeah, true, we invented CADPAT. Yeah, that was us, by the way. Anyone wondering? CADPAT, we did that. That was Canadians. Yeah. In Brain Hack News, the problem with to-do lists and schedules is that you need to fill them out. Now, a new generation of free online schedulers promises to end the drudgery. That would be the drudgery of you choosing what you do with your time. These new web applications use natural language processing to interpret spoken commands in an ordinary written senses to build calendars and personal organizers. Holy shit. Perhaps the simplest new generation of schedules is Presto, based in San Francisco, which launched in late April to help users collaborate to schedule meetings and other events. Borrowing Google's successful bag of tricks, Presto's homepage is as simple as it gets. Just a floating text box. Type in, have brunch with Margaret on Sunday, and Presto translates your command into data, bringing you a page where you and your guests can check and tweak the details of your event. By taking its cues from the ways people naturally talk about time, the software frees users to be general by dates and times, says Presto founder Eric Lai. Imprecise phrases like next month, which would be impossible to put on a calendar without picking a particular date and time, are allowed to stay fluid for as long as the user wants them to. There's no widget in our system that looks anything like a calendar, and that was intentional, says Lai. We really wanted to make it easy for people to express what they wanted in terms of time. We felt the natural language approach was going to be more flexible and expressive for the users. If you sign up as a regular user, Presto will gather information and help you guess automatically. For example, it will suggest restaurants near where you live via Google Maps, or will remember Margaret's email address from your last event together. By translating the vagaries of ordinary speech into data that the computer can understand through a technical is a tough technical problem. One thing made me acutely aware of how weirdly people speak, says Rael Dornfest, developer of I Want Sandy, an online personal assistant program based in Portland, Oregon, that uses simple text-based interactions to generate a calendar, items, to-do lists, and reminders. Awesome. So we're starting to build like quasi-AIs to help us keep track of our lives. Interesting. And just, you know, speaking of things that are keeping tracks of your lives, how about some floating taser droids? Yeah, baby, June 12th of this year, flying saucers may soon be more fact than mere science fiction. University of Florida Mechanical and Aerospace Engineer Associate Professor Subrata Roy has submitted a patent application for a circular spinning aircraft design reminiscent of the spaceship seen in countless Hollywood films. Roy, however, calls his design a wingless electromagnetic air vehicle, or a weave. The proposed prototype is a small. The aircraft will measure less than 6 inches across and will be efficient enough to be powered by onboard batteries. Holy crap. Roy said the design can be scaled up and theoretically should work in a much larger form. Even in miniature, though, the design has many uses. The most obvious functions would be surveillance and navigation. The aircraft could be designed to carry a camera and lights to be controlled remotely at great distances, he said. Fittingly, Roy said his flying saucer would one day soar through the atmosphere other than Earth's own. For example, the aircraft would be an ideal vehicle for the exploration of Saturn Titan 6 move, which has high air density and very low gravity, Roy said. Wow, this guy's thinking ahead, eh? The U.S. Air Force and NASA have expressed interest in the aircraft, as well as everybody else who's got a brain in their head. And the university is seeking to license the design. The vehicle will be powered by a phenomenon called magnetohydrodynamics, or the force created when a current or magnetic field passes through a conducting fluid. In the case of Roy's aircraft, a conducting fluid will be created by electrodes that cover the Earth, that cover each of the vehicle surfaces and ionized the surrounding air into plasma. The force created by passing electrical current through this plasma pushes around the surrounding air, and that swirling air creates lift and momentum and provides stability against wind gusts. In order to maximize the area of contact between the air and the vehicles, Roy's design is partially hollow and continuously curved like an electromagnetic flying bunt pan. One of the most revolutionary aspects of Roy's use of magnetohydrodynamics is the vehicle will have no moving parts. No moving parts in a 6-inch wide hover drone. Baldi, they made that thing that you made, the little robot that flies. Yeah, you can do that now in real life, apparently. One of the most, it has no moving parts. That's so hot. The lack of traditional mechanical aircraft parts, such as propellers or jet engines, should provide tremendous reliability, Roy said. Such a design will allow the Weave to hover and take off vertically. Of course, I think if you touch this thing, you're liable to cook off. Though the design is promising on paper, towering obstacles stand between the blueprint and liftoff. No plasma-propelled aircraft has successfully taken flight on Earth. Such designs have found some success in space, where gravity and drag are minimal, but a vehicle hoping to fly in Earth's atmosphere will need at least an order of magnitude more thrust, Roy said. Also, the power source needs to be seemingly lightweight, yet still produce enough power to generate the necessary plasma. Not to mention the fact the very same plasma will allow the aircraft to fly will interfere with the electromagnetic waves necessary for communication with the vehicle. Huh. So it has to be autonomous, I see. Interesting. Well, I'm not totally opposed to that. You know, I think that maybe having stuff like that isn't entirely bad. I mean, it's all about how you use it. Technology is a tool. And realistically, you're only as good as your drugs and technology make you. Really. Let's be honest about this. And one of the things that I don't really talk about that much is guns. I don't talk about guns much. I don't talk about my stance on guns. I try to avoid it in all my stuff because I don't like being an advocate of violence. Violence is a tool. You should never use it when you're angry. But I'm just saying that there's certain things that we need to understand about guns. So let's look at some facts about guns. This was sent to me by the moon. Guns save, number one, guns save more lives than they take, prevent more injuries than they inflict. Guns used 2.5 million times a year in self-defense. Law-abiding citizens use guns to defend themselves against criminals as many as 2.5 million times every year, or about 6,850 times a day. That means each year, firearms are used more than 80 times more. Each year, firearms are used more than 80 times more often to protect the lives of honest citizens than to take lives. Of the 2.5 million times citizens use their gun to defend themselves every year, the overwhelming majority merely brandish their gun or fire a warning shot to scare off their attackers. Less than 8% of the time, a citizen will kill or wound his or her attacker. As many as 200,000 women use a gun every year to defend themselves against sexual abuse. 200,000. Even anti-gun Clinton researchers concede that guns are used 1.5 million times annually for self-defense. According to the Clinton Justice Department, there are as many as 1.5 million cases of self-defense every year. The National Institute of Justice published this figure in 1997 as part of Guns America, a study which was authored by the noted anti-gun criminologist Philip Cook and Jens Lundwig. Armed citizens kill more crooks than do the police. Citizens shoot and kill at least twice as many criminals as police do every year. 1,500 to 606. And readers of Newsweek learned that only 2% of civilian shootings involving an innocent person mistakenly identified as a criminal. The error rate for the police, however, was 11%, more than five times as high. Handguns are the weapon of choice for self-defense. Citizens use handguns to protect themselves over 1.9 million times a year. Many of these self-defense handguns could be labeled as Saturday Night Specials. This is all. I've got the links for all of this, okay? So I've got the studies that, you know, back all this up. Number two, concealed carry laws help reduce crime. Nationwide, one half million self-defense uses every year. As many as 500,000 citizens defend themselves with a firearm away from home. Concealed carry laws are dropping crime rates across the country. A comprehensive national study determined in 1996 that violent crime fell after states made it legal to carry concealed firearms. The results of studies showed that states which passed concealed carry laws reduced their murder rate by 8.5% and rapes by 5%, aggravated assaults by 7%, and robbery by 3%. If those states not having concealed carry laws had adopted such laws in 1992, there would be approximately 1,570 murders, 4,177 rapes, 60,000 aggravated assaults, and over 11,000 robberies would have been avoided early. Vermont, one of the safest five states in the country. In Vermont, citizens can carry a firearm without getting permission or without paying a fee, without going through any kind of government-imposed waiting period. And yet, for 10 years in a row, Vermont has remained one of the top five safest states in the union, having three times received the Safest State Award. Florida, concealed carry helped slash the murder rates in the state. 15 years later, it goes on and on and on and on, guys. Okay, so, it's over. Okay, we know what's going on. We know what's happening with the whole does gun control work? Yeah, it works at making sure your criminals have control. I think firearms should be legal, and I think they should be, I believe in owning guns. I do. I think it's a pretty good idea. It's just how I stand, and there's a lot of, you don't really have to have an opinion. You just have to look at the facts and go, yeah, well, if they're legal, it tends to cut down on the crime. Because if only, if guns are outlawed, only the outlaws have the guns, and then the good guys, well, they wind up taking it in the teeth. That's just sort of a general guideline, I find. Today's Daily Hack, we've got drive slagging. This was sent in by Paladin. Very, very cool. Maybe you wiped your iPhone by filing your hard drive with music, but maybe you used a more sophisticated method. In either case, your phone is clean, but the hard drive in your computer is still chock full of evidence of your misdeeds, or just your personal emails to your mother. If your fear forensic analyst will expose your wheelings and dealings, then a full format is not enough. You're going to have to obliterate the plates inside the hard drive. To that... posted on the work log is a work log of slagging a hard drive. To use a propane-powered furnace, melting most of the drive components by placing it in a steel crucible, which is lowered into the furnace. After a few minutes, everything but the steel casing and a few bits of woven fiberglass from the PVC were melted down and completely. You could see the entire process in the drive slagging photo album. With solid-state drives becoming popular, and inherent difficulty of assuring erasure, physical destruction is looking like a lot more reasonable option. As your readers have stated in the past, it's certainly a lot more fun. As well, I've got another good one here. Some do-it-yourself wiretapping. Very, very cool. Wiretapping is certainly a controversial issue today. Though it's downright creepy for a regular citizen to spy on his or her neighbors without just cause, the FBI, NSA, and even business owners have been known to use wiretapping devices to learn more about criminals, suspects, terrorists, and their employees. Even if you aren't involved with a criminal case or a legal operation, it's incredibly easy to set up a wiretap or a surveillance system on any type of phone. Don't be surprised to learn that virtually anyone could be spying on you for any reason. Very, very interesting. And as well, of course, as promised, I have the 1944 Sabotage Manual sent in by Enki. Very, very cool. Enki's, of course, the guy who's responsible to make sure the show stays up, stays running, gets distributed. He's our webmaster, a master ninja, and generally just a badass mofo. Now, this is the thing I was talking about. From that manual, okay, this is what they say. If you want to fuck something up, okay, if you want to destroy an organization, you do this. Insist on doing everything through channels. Never permit shortcuts to be taken in order to expedite decisions. This is if you want to destroy a company. Make speeches. Talk frequently at possible great length. Illustrate your points by long anecdotes, doubts of personal experiences. Never hesitate to make a few appropriate patriotic comments. When possible, refer all matters to committees for further study and consideration. Attempt to make committees as large as possible, never less than 5. Bring up irrelevant issues as frequently as possible. Haggle over precise wordings of communication minutes and resolutions. Refer back to matters decided upon at the last meeting and attempt to reopen the question of the advisability of that decision. Advocate caution. Be responsible and urge your fellow conference to be responsible to avoid haste which might result in embarrassments or difficulties later on. Be worried about the property, about the proprietary of any decision. Raise the question of whether such action is contemplated lies within the jurisdiction of the group or whether it might be in conflict with the policy of some higher echelon. And this is what they do in the corporate world. It's really bizarre. I don't really understand why people do this, but I guess it's pretty common. And that's all I got for you this week. I know, you're thinking short so, but wait for it. I got something good for you here. I'll be back next week to make sure you get the news you need to survive. This has been a free podcast brought to you by the Wogs UK. If you cannot donate, do distribute to the show. And if you can, if you can't donate, distribute to the show. If you cannot donate, please distribute the show. And if you can donate, please do so by going to the Dark Atlas website and clicking on the donate tab. If I can just get over my words, I'll be fine. Or you can send it a cleverly disguised envelope to Ray Media Studios, Box 18121, 1215C, 56th Street, Delta, BC, Canada, V4M 2M4. I want to thank the Armor of Flying Monkeys for their assistance in gathering data. And if you have information you'd like to send me, you can reach me at newsreel@randradio.com. Now, I'm going to fade out now with something that's just mighty. Anyone who's anyone knows who Dan Rather is. Dan Rather has been reporting the news forever. The guy's a god, okay? He's one of these kind of guys who you have no right to pass any judgment on because he has been the original. He was like the original gargoyle in the emergence of the future. Okay, this guy is just he's very, very, you know, you should respect Dan Rather is what I'm saying here. And Dan Rather addressed the 2008 National Conference on Media Reform in Minneapolis on Saturday, where he warned of the dangers of the corporate media ownership. And I have his speech here in its entirety. So I give this a listen because you'll realize that it's not just a bunch of crazy people on the internet saying this stuff. It's it goes a bit deeper than that. It goes a bit further than that. There's a lot of things going on out there in the world right now that are just frightening, and we need to make sure that there is room for the truth, and there is room for objectivity. After this wonderful, wonderful speech by Dan, the man Rather, I've got an awesome track from a band called BitKit. I think it's just one guy, bitkit.de. If you go, it's on the Recomedia link of the site. Very, very cool stuff. The song is called Artelect. I just think it's really neat. It's got some awesome quotes in it, and I'm sure this guy's going to have a wicked, wicked career. So go there, check it out. If you're over in Europe, check out his shows. Tell him I think he's amazing. Tell him I wish him all the best, because this guy's pretty freaking cool. And of course, in the background, I've got your general selection of Psytrance. I think what I've got in the background of this one is some Astral Projection. So until next time, everybody, remember, we'll never defeat the enemy if we're at each other's throats. And end of line.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. I trust all of you know what Abe Lincoln said about overly generous introductions such as that one. Honest Abe said, never take time to deny it. The audience will find out soon enough for themselves. And so it will be with you tonight. I'm grateful to be here, and I am most of all gratified by the energy that I've seen tonight at this conference. My friends, it will take that kind of energy and more to sustain what is good in our news media, to improve what is deficient, and to push back against the forces and the trends that imperil journalism and that, by immediate extension, imperil freedom and democracy itself. The framers of our Constitution enshrined freedom of the press in the very First Amendment, up at the top of the Bill of Rights, not because they were fans of journalism. Like many politicians then and now, they were not, but rather because they knew, as Thomas Jefferson put it, that if a nation expects to be ignorant and free, it expects what never was and never will be. And it is because of this constitutionally protected and guaranteed role that I still prefer to use the word press over the word media. If nothing else, it serves as a subtle reminder that along with newspapers, radio, television, and now the internet, carry the same constitutional rights, mandates, and responsibilities that the founders guaranteed for those who plied their trade solely in print. So when you hear me talk about the press, please know that I'm talking about all the ways that news can be transmitted. And by the way, when you hear me criticize and critique the press, please know that I do not accept myself from these criticisms. In our efforts to take back the American press for the American people, we are blessed this weekend with the gift of good timing. For anyone who may have been inclined to ask if there really is a problem with the news media, or wonder if the task of media reform is indeed an urgent one, recent days have brought an inescapable answer from a most unlikely source, a source who decided to tell everyone, quote, what happened. I know I can't be the first person this weekend to reference the recent book by former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan, but having interviewed him this last week, I think there's some very important points to be made from the things he says in the book and the questions his statements raise. I'm sure all of you took special notice of what he had to say about the role of the press corps in the run-up to the war in Iraq. In the government's selling of the war, in McClellan's phrase, marketing of the war, he said they were, or I should say, we in the press were, quote, complicit enablers, end quote, overly deferential, end quote. These are interesting statements, especially considering the source. As one tries to wrap one's mind around them, the phrase cognitive dissonance comes to mind, that is, two different opposite reactions. The first reaction is a visceral one. It is, whatever his motives for saying these things, he's right, and we didn't need Scott McClellan to tell us so. But the second reaction is, wait a minute, I do remember that at least some reporters and some news organizations asking tough questions, asking them of the president, of those in the administration, of White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer, and oh yes, of Scott McClellan himself, once he took over from Mr. Fleischer a few months after the invasion. The McClatchy newspapers, for example, asked some of the tough questions. So how do we reconcile these competing reactions? Well, we need to pull back for what we call in television the wide shot. If we look at the wide shot, we can see in one corner of our screen the White House briefing room filled with the White House press corps, and filling the rest of the screen, the finite but disproportionately powerful universe that has become known as mainstream media. The newspapers and news programs, real and alleged, that employ these White House correspondents. The news organizations that are in turn owned by a shockingly few much larger corporations, for which news is but a minuscule part of their overall business interests. In the wake of 9/11 and in the run-up to Iraq, these news organizations made a decision, consciously or unconsciously, but unquestionably in a climate of fear, to accept the overall narrative frame given them by the White House, a narrative that went like this. Saddam Hussein, brutal dictator, harbored weapons of mass destruction, and because of his supposed links to Al-Qaeda, this could not be tolerated in a post-9/11 world. In the news and on the news, one could, to be sure, find persons and views that did not agree with all or parts of this official narrative. Hans Blix, the former UN weapons inspector, comes to mind as an example. But the burden of proof, implicitly or explicitly, was put on these dissenting views in persons. The burden of proof was not put on an administration that was demonstrably moving toward a large-scale military action that would represent a break with American precedent and stated policy of how, when, and under what circumstances this nation goes to war. So with this in mind, we look back to the corner of the screen where the White House press corps is asking their questions. I was a White House correspondent for 10 years, and I have worked with some of the best in the business. You have an incentive when you are in that briefing room to ask the good, tough questions. There is an incentive. If nothing else, that is how you get in the paper or on the air. There's more to it than that, and things certainly have changed since I was a White House correspondent, something I want to talk to you about in a minute. But the correspondents, the really good ones, these correspondents ask their tough questions. And these questions are met with what is now called, euphemistically and much too kindly, what is now called message discipline. Well, we used to have a better and more accurate term for message discipline. We called it stonewalling, or something more direct. Now, cut back. Remember in television's wide shot. Now cut back to your evening news or your daily newspaper, where that White House correspondent dutifully repeats the question he asked of the president or his press secretary and dutifully relates the answer he was given, the same non-answer that we already heard dozens of times, which amounts to a pitch for the administration's point of view, whether or not the answer had anything to do with the actual question that was asked. And then, thank you, Jack. Now, in other news today, and we're off on a whole new story. In our news media, in our press, those who wield power were, in the lead-up to the Iraq War, given the opportunity to present their views as a coherent whole, to connect the dots as they saw the dots and connections. No matter how much these views may have flown in the face of precedent, established practice, or indeed the facts, as we are reminded yet again by the just-released Senate report on the administration's use of pre-war intelligence, the powerful are given this opportunity still, in ways big and small, despite what you may hear about the post-Katrina press. But when a tough question is asked and not answered, when reputable people come before the public and say, wait a minute, something's not right here, the press has treated them like voices crying in the wilderness. These views, though they might be given airtime, become lone dots, dots that journalists all too often do not dare connect, even if the connections are obvious, even if people on the internet and the independent press are making these very same connections. The mainstream press doesn't connect these dots because someone might then accuse them of editorializing or of being the, quote, liberal media or unpatriotic. But connecting these dots, making disparate facts make sense, is a big part of what is supposed to be the real work of journalism. So how does this happen? How does it happen? Why does this happen? Let me say by way of answering that good journalism starts with an owner who has guts and a sense of public service. In a news organization whose owner has guts, there is an incentive to ask tough questions, and there is incentive to pull together the facts, to connect the dots in a way that makes coherent sense to the news audience. I mentioned a moment ago that things have changed since I was a White House correspondent. Yes, presidential administrations have become more adept at holding access over the heads of reporters. You ask a tough question, or too many of them, so the implicit threat goes, and you're not going to get any more interviews with high-ranking members of the administration, let alone the president. But I was covering Presidents Johnson, Nixon, and Ford, men not known as exactly pushovers. No, what has changed, even more than the nature of the presidency, is the character and the actions of news ownership. I only found out years after the fact, for example, about the pressure that the Nixon White House put on my then bosses during Watergate, that widespread criminal conspiracy that was based in the Oval Office itself. Pressure to cut down my pieces, to call me off the story and so on. Because back then, my bosses took the heat, so I didn't have to. They did this so the story could get told and so the public could be informed. But it is rare now to find a major news organization owned by an individual, someone who can say, in effect, the buck stops here. The more likely motto now is, the news stops with making bucks. America's biggest, most important news organizations, in the main and on the whole, have, over the past 25 years, fallen prey to merger after merger, acquisition after acquisition, to the point where they are now tiny parts of immeasurably larger corporate entities, entities whose primary business often has nothing to do with news, entities that may, at any given time, have literally hundreds of regulatory and or legislative issues before multiple arms of the government concerning a vast array of business interests. These are entities that, as publicly held and traded corporations, have as their overall reigning mandate provide a return on shareholder value, increase profits, and not over time, not over the long haul, but quarterly. One might ask just where the news fits into this model. And if you really need an answer, you can turn on your television where you will see the following. Political analysis reduced to in-studio shouting matches between partisans armed with little more than the day's talking points. Precious time and resources wasted on so-called human interest stories, celebrity fluff, sensational trials, and gossip. A proliferation of news you can use that amounts to thinly disguised press releases for the latest consumer products. And though this doesn't get said enough, local newscasts, which is where most Americans get their news, that seems not to change no matter what town or city you're in. So slavish is its adherence to the happy talk formula and the dictum that if it bleeds, it leads. And if you lead with or even spend much time on international stories, you, your ratings, and your program die. I could continue for hours, I know you'd be relieved to know that I won't, cataloging journalistic sins of which I know you're all too aware. But as the time and this hour grows late, let me say that almost all of these failings come down to this. In the current model of corporate news ownership, the incentive to produce good and valuable news is simply not there. Good journalism, quality news of integrity, good journalism and quality news of integrity requires resources and it requires talent. These things are expensive. These things eat away at the bottom line. Years ago, in the 80s and 90s, when the implications of these cost-trimming measures were becoming impossible to ignore, and the quality of the news was clearly threatened, I and others spoke out against this cutting of news operations to the bone and beyond. Even then, though, I could not have imagined that the cost-cutting imperatives would go as far as they have today, deep into the marrow of what was once considered a public trust. But since the financial resources always seem to be available for entertainment, promotion, and last but not least, for lobbying, perhaps there's an even more important reason why the incentive to produce quality news is absent, and that is, quality news of integrity, by its very nature, is sure to rock the boat now and then. Good, responsible, newsworthy of its constitutional protections, news will, in that famous phrase, afflict the powerful and comfort the afflicted. And that, when one feels the need to deliver shareholder value above all, means that good news may not always mean good business, or so goes the fear. A fear that filters down into just about every big newsroom in this country. Now, I've spent my entire life in for-profit news, and I happen to believe, on the basis of my experience, that it does not have to be this way. I have worked for news owners who, while they may have regarded their news divisions as an occasional irritant, chose to turn that irritant into a pearl of public trust. But today, sadly, it seems that the conglomerates that have control over some of the biggest pieces of this public trust would just as soon spit that irritant out. So what does this mean for us tonight, and what is to be done? It means that we need to be on the alert for where, when, and how our news media bows to undue government influence. And you need to let news organizations know in no uncertain terms that you won't stand for it, that you, as news consumers, are capable of exerting pressure of your own. It means that we need to continue to let our government know that when it comes to media consolidation, enough is enough. Too few voices are dominating, homogenizing, and marginalizing the news. We need to demand that the American people get something in exchange for the use of airways that belong, after all, to the people. It means that we need to ensure that the Internet, where free speech reigns and where journalism does not have to pass through a corporate filter, remains free. We need to say loud and clear that we don't want big corporations enjoying preferred access to our government acting as the gatekeeper for this unique platform for independent journalism, the Internet. And it means that we need to hold the government to its mandate to protect the freedom of the press including independent and non-commercial news media. We need to make hold the government to both the idea and the ideal that the red beating heart of freedom and democracy is a free, truly free, and independent, yes, fiercely independent when necessary, press. The stakes could not possibly be higher. Scott McClellan's book serves as a reminder. And the current election season, not to mention the gathering clouds of conflict over Iran, will both serve as tests of whether lessons have truly been learned from past experience. Ensuring that a free press remains free will require vigilance and it will require work. Please, take tonight's energy and inspiration home with you. Take it back to your desks and your workplaces, to your colleagues and your fellow citizens. Magnify it, multiply it, and spread it. Make it viral. Make it something that cannot be ignored, not by the powers in Washington, not by the owners and executives of media companies. Write these people. Call them. Send them the message loud, clear, and often that you know your rights. You know that you are entitled to news media as diverse and varied as the American people, and that you deserve a press that provides the raw material of democracy, the good information that Americans need to be full participants in our government of, by, and for the people. There is energy here that can be equal to that task, but this energy must be maintained if the press, if freedom and democracy are to be preserved. Thank you very much. Good night.
This class is social studies. That is you and the world. Yes, there is a world out there, and even if you decide you don't want to meet it, it's still going to hit you right in the face. Believe me. So, best you start thinking about the world now and what it means to you. What does the world mean to you? Come on, a little class participation here. Is it just this class you want to get out of? Your house? Your street? Come on, a little class participation here. Yes? No? All right, so we're not global figures yet, but why aren't we? Seventh grade.